You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 232 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Mystery Knowledge and Mystery Centers, 14 Lectures, revised translation by Paula Verla. This is Lecture 2, entitled The Working of the Soul on the Human Body, given on the 24th of November, 1923. If we seek for a transition from the life of the soul itself, to which we devoted some attention yesterday, to the creative way the soul works on the human physical body, particularly in connection with the experiences then described, we are led in two different directions. Memory, of course, initially points the soul back to earlier experiences, and, as I told you yesterday, thinking leads the soul into the realm of etheric experience. That which affects a person even more strongly than memory, so strongly, in fact, that the inner impulses pass over into his bodily life, I called gesture. And the study of gesture brings us to the subject of how the soul and spirit manifest in the physical body. The entry of the human being into physical life on earth is a process in which the being of soul and spirit takes hold of the physical element. And remaining with memory for the moment, this consists of something experienced previously in earthly existence being carried over into later life. The question now is, just as memory points back to earlier happenings, confined to the course of earthly life, is it possible to look farther back to what preceded the entry of a human being into this life? Here we come to two factors. On the one hand, there are the experiences a human being has undergone as a being of soul and spirit in pre-earthly existence. We shall leave this for later consideration. On the other hand, there is something that is connected with his physical bodily constitution, which he, as an individual, carries over into that bodily constitution. It is what, from a scientific point of view, we call heredity. In the very traits of his temperament, which have a considerable effect on his life of soul, a person bears within him qualities and impulses that have an obvious connection with those of his physical ancestors. Modern humanity approaches such matters somewhat superficially, with little real thought. Only this morning, while I was traveling, I read a book dealing with the head of a well-known, now extinct, royal family, and the effect of heredity on the dynasty. The author mentions characteristics that can be traced right back to the 7th century and were repeatedly inherited. Then comes a strange passage to the effect that some members of this royal family have displayed a marked tendency toward freakish behavior, eccentricity, and the like, while others have no such tendencies. You will agree that this is a peculiar way of thinking, for surely a writer who makes such a statement ought to realize that no conclusions whatever can be drawn from it. But if you examine a lot of what at the present time is supposed to lead to so-called well-founded views, you will find plenty of similar examples. However superficial prevailing views of heredity seem to be, it must be admitted that a person is indeed the bearer of inherited characteristics. This is the one aspect. He must often battle against these inherited traits and rid himself of them in order to bring to fulfillment the talents laid into him before he entered earthly existence. The second aspect to be noted has to do with what a human being acquires through education, through his dealings with other people and also with outer nature. Customary study of the lower kingdoms of nature leads us to speak of this as the adaptation of human beings to their environment. As you know, modern natural science regards these two impulses, heredity and adaptation, as influences of supreme importance for a living being. But if we go into these things with an open mind, we feel that we cannot reach any real explanation of them without taking the path into the spiritual world. And so, today, we shall consider, in the light of spiritual knowledge, these questions which meet us in life at every turn. We must go back here to something with which we have been repeatedly concerned in earlier studies, namely the separation of the moon from the earth. The moon separated from the earth at a particular time in order to influence it from a distance. But I have also spoken of the spiritual reality behind this separation of the moon. I have told you how at one time there lived on the earth superhuman beings who were the first great teachers of humanity, and from whom originated what our human thinking may call the primeval wisdom. It is of deep significance and inspires reverence even in the fragmentary form in which it survives today. It was once actually the content of what was taught by those superhuman teachers at the time when the evolution of earthly humanity was beginning. These beings found their way up to the moon sphere and are now part of the moon population. Now, when a human being has passed through the gate of death, he journeys by a series of stages through the planetary world belonging to our Earth. After his earthly existence, he enters, first of all, into the sphere of the moon's activities, then into the spheres of Venus, Mercury, the Sun, and so on. Today we are particularly concerned with how he passes into the moon's sphere of activities. I have already indicated here that with imaginative vision, the life of a human being can be followed beyond the gate of death, and that in actual fact, after his physical body has been laid aside and returned to the elements of earth, he is to be found in the world of the spirit. After his etheric body has been received into the etheric sphere, connected with our earth, soul and spirit remain, that is to say, his ego and astral body, and all that is part of them. But when we follow with imaginative vision this being who has passed through the gate of death, he still presents himself to us in a definite form. It is the form which gives shape to the physical matter which the person bears within him. Compared with the robust physical body, this form is little more than a shadow, but makes a very forceful impression on the soul. In this form, the head makes only a weak impression, whereas a very powerful impression is made by what, in the course of the life between death and a new birth, is gradually transformed into the head of the new incarnation. But there is something important to say about this form that is visible to imaginative perception after a human being has passed through the gate of death. The form is a kind of physiognomical expression of his life on earth. It is a faithful portrayal of the manifestations of the good and evil for which he was responsible in his physical life on earth. In earthly life, a person can conceal whether evil or good is active in his soul. After death, this is no longer possible. The spirit form presents after death the physiognomical expression of what the person was on earth. A human being who carries through the gate of death some moral evil inherent in his soul will bear a physiognomy in which there is an outer resemblance to Ahrimanic forms. During the first period after death, it is a fact that a person's feeling and perception are dependent on what he can reproduce in his own being. If he has a physiognomical resemblance to Ahriman, because he has carried some moral evil with him through the gate of death, he can reproduce in himself, which means he can perceive, only things that resemble Ahriman. And he is, as it were, blind to those human souls who passed through the gate of death with a sound and good moral disposition. Indeed, it is one of the sternest judgments confronting a human being after death, that insofar as he is himself evil, he can see only what resembles himself, because he can reproduce in his own being only the physiognomy of other evil people. After death, human beings enter into the sphere of the moon, and there, if they bring evil with them, they come into the presence not only of supersensible, superphysical beings, but also into that of others, with a physiognomical resemblance to themselves, that is to say, to Ahrimanic figures. This passage of certain individuals through an Ahrimanic world has very definite significance in the whole nexus of cosmic happenings. And we shall grasp what actually happens if we bear in mind the purpose of those ancient teachers of humanity when they departed to establish the moon colony in the cosmos. Now, as well as those beings of the higher hierarchies, whom we usually call angels, archangels, and so forth, other beings who belong to the Ahrimanic and the Luciferic realms are also bound up with the whole process, just as are the normally developing beings. The Luciferic beings work continuously with the aim of preventing anything that has the tendency to press on into physical materiality from achieving that end. In the human realm, the Luciferic beings use every opportunity to lift human beings away from their physical corporeality. Their endeavor is to make them into purely etheric beings possessed of soul and spirit. The endeavor of the Ahrimanic beings is to separate human beings from everything that urges them toward the soul and spirit, which has to be developed in the human kingdom. They want to transform into spirit the subhuman elements, the instincts and urges, everything that comes to expression in the body. In their own way, both the Luciferic and the Ahrimanic beings want to change humanity into spirit. But while the Luciferic beings want to draw the soul and spirit out of human beings, so that they would cease to concern themselves with their earthly incarnations, but would prefer living as beings of soul and spirit only, the Ahrimanic beings would like to disregard soul and spirit entirely and detach from human beings what has been given them as a sheath, a covering, an instrument in the physical and etheric realm, and bring it all into their own realm. And so on the one hand, humanity faces the beings of the normally developing hierarchies. But because human beings are interwoven with the whole of existence, they are also faced by the Luciferic and Ahrimanic beings. So whenever the Luciferic beings endeavor to approach human beings, their purpose is to estrange them from the earth. Whereas, on the other hand, when the Ahrimanic beings make efforts to dominate human beings, their aim is to make their nature more and more earthly, changing the earth in the process into spirit, consisting of dense spiritual substance and dense spiritual forces. In speaking of spiritual matters, one sometimes has to use expressions that may seem grotesque when applied to such matters. But one has, after all, to use human language. So you will allow me to use ordinary words, even when I am speaking of something that takes place on a purely spiritual plane. You will understand me and will yourselves raise what I say onto a spiritual level. Those beings who at the beginning of earth existence brought the primal wisdom to humanity withdrew to the moon in order, as far as lay in their power, to establish the right relationship of the Luciferic and the Ahrimanic beings to the life of human beings. Why was that necessary? Why was it necessary for beings as exalted as these primordial teachers to elect to leave the earth, which for a time had been their field of action, and proceed to the extraterrestrial moon in order to create the possibility for the right relationship of the Luciferic and Ahrimanic beings to human beings? When, in a soul spiritual form, a human being descends from his pre-earthly existence into the earth sphere, he traverses the path I described in the course of lectures entitled Cosmology, Religion, and Philosophy. As a being of soul and spirit, he unites with the physical embryo provided for him in the direct line of heredity by father and mother. These two components, the physical embryo and the spiritual element, interpenetrate and unite. And in that way a human being enters into existence on earth. But in the line of heredity, in the inherited characteristics transmitted by ancestors to their descendants, there lie points of attack for the Ahrimanic beings. The Ahrimanic forces lie in the forces of heredity. And if a person has many of these inherited impulses in him, he will have a bodily makeup to which the ego cannot satisfactorily gain access. Indeed, the secret of many human beings is that they have within them too many inherited qualities. This is what is meant today by saying that a person is burdened by heredity. The consequence is that the ego cannot fully penetrate that person's body, cannot adequately take possession of the various bodily organs. The body then develops an activity of its own, independent of the impulse of the ego, which should rightly be working in the body. Thus, through their efforts to put as much as possible into heredity, the Ahrimanic powers succeed in ensuring that the ego is only very loosely connected with the human being. That is the one aspect. But human beings have also to adapt themselves to external conditions. This is very evident when you think of the effect of climate and other geographical conditions on human beings. This effect of the purely natural environment is extraordinarily significant for us. There were even times when the wise leaders of humanity made use of it in particular ways. When we consider a certain remarkable phenomenon in ancient Greek culture, namely the difference between Spartans and Athenians, we shall realize that this difference, which is described very superficially in our history textbooks, is based ultimately on measures adopted in the ancient mysteries, and the effect of these measures on the Spartans differed from that made on the Athenians. In Greece, as you know, great value was attached to gymnastics. Gymnastics was regarded as the most essential part of a child's education, because through controlling and directing the body in a particular way, an effect was made on the nature of spirit and soul by methods characteristic of the Greeks. But the method used by the Spartans was different from the one used by the Athenians. The Spartans were primarily concerned to ensure that by means of their gymnastic exercises, the boy's development should depend as completely as possible on what the body, by itself alone, could achieve. Thus, Spartan boys were obliged to carry out their exercises regardless of weather conditions. Among the Athenians, it was different. They attached great importance to the gymnastic exercises being adapted to weather conditions, and insisted that the boys, doing the exercises, should be exposed to the sunlight in the appropriate way. To the Spartans, it was a matter of indifference whether the exercises were carried out in rain or sunshine. The Athenians demanded that there be a stimulus, particularly the stimulating effect of the sun. The treatment given to a Spartan boy was intended to make his skin impervious, so that the whole effect should come from the body. The Athenian boy did not have his skin treated with sand and oil, but he was exposed to the influence of the sun. The Athenian boys received from outside all the effects the sun can have on human beings. They were encouraged to speak and to use beautiful language. The Spartan boys, on the other hand, were enclosed in themselves as the result of all kinds of massage with oil. Indeed, the purpose of massaging the skin with sand and oil was so that their development could take place entirely independently of outer nature. They were trained to drive whatever forces can be developed by human nature back into themselves, and not to allow them to emerge. Thus a Spartan boy, unlike an Athenian boy, did not become talkative. He was trained to be sparing with words, to say little, to remain silent. If he did say anything, it had to be important, have real content. Speeches made by Spartans were rare, but were renowned for their content. Speeches made by Athenians were renowned for the beauty of their language. All this was connected with the adaptation of human beings to their environment by means of the appropriate system of education. You can see this elsewhere in the relationship that is established between human beings and their environment. Southerners, who are exposed to the maximum of sun influences, gesticulate a great deal and are talkative. Their speech is melodious because there is a connection between their own warmth and the warmth outside. Northerners, on the other hand, are not talkative because they have to hold on to the stimulus their bodily warmth gives them. Northerners are notorious for their silence. They will sit together evening after evening without feeling the urge to say much. One of them may ask a question, and not until 2 hours later, or not until the following evening, will he get a yes or a no in reply. The reason for this is that it is necessary for Northerners to have a strong impulse within them to produce warmth, because warmth does not come to them from outside. Here you have examples of what we can call human adaptation to external conditions of the natural world. Just think of the effects of all this in education and in other spheres of the life of soul and spirit. Just as the Ahrimanic beings exercise a considerable influence on what lies in heredity, Luciferic beings exert a considerable influence on adaptation to the environment. They can approach the human being when he is establishing a relationship to the external world. They entangle the human eye, capital, in the external world. But in so doing, they often bring about confusion between this I and karma. Whereas the Ahrimanic beings bring the human I into confusion in regard to his physical impulses, the Luciferic beings bring the I into confusion in regard to his karma. For what comes from the external world does not always lie in immediate karma, but must first be woven into karma by means of many threads and bonds so that it can have a place in future karma. Thus the Ahrimanic and the Luciferic powers are intimately connected with human life. This state of things must be regulated in the process of the whole of human evolution. This is why it became necessary for the primeval teachers of humanity to leave the earth, where such regulation would not have been possible. It cannot be undertaken during a person's earthly life, and when that life is over, he is obviously not on the earth. The primeval teachers were therefore obliged to withdraw from the earth and continue their existence on the moon. And then, when they had withdrawn to the moon, and here I must use ordinary language for something which one would prefer to clothe in different word pictures, these wise teachers came to an arrangement with the Ahrimanic and the Luciferic powers. Now the effect of the Ahrimanic beings on human existence after death would have been particularly harmful if they could have exercised a real influence on it. For when a human being goes through the gate of death, bearing the after effects of anything evil in his soul, he finds himself, as I have told you, in an entirely Ahrimanic environment. He will even hold Ahrimanic views, and he himself has an Ahrimanic physiognomy. He could perceive only those human beings who have a similar appearance. All this must remain purely an experience in the soul. If Ahriman could now intervene and influence the astral body, this would become a force which Ahriman could propel into humanity, a force that would not only gradually find its karmic balance, but would make human beings very closely related to the earth, bringing them into too close a connection with it. That indeed is the endeavor of the Ahrimanic beings. While the person, after death, in his spirit form still resembles his earthly form, the Ahrimanic powers strive to gain access to him by way of the evil impulses he carries with him through the gate of death. They want to permeate this spirit form with forces, to draw as many of such beings as possible down to earthly existence, and so to speak, to establish there an Ahrimanic earth humanity. It was for this reason that the primeval teachers now inhabiting the moon sphere made a contract with the Ahrimanic powers, a contract which those powers were obliged to accept for reasons which I will explain later. Under the terms of this contract, the Ahrimanic powers were allowed to exercise their influence in the fullest sense of the word, and within the limits of possibility, on the lives of human beings before they descend to earthly existence. Thus, in accordance with the agreement reached between the primeval teachers and the Ahrimanic powers, when human beings are again passing through the moon sphere on their way to earth, these powers may have a certain influence on them. And this influence comes to expression in the fact that heredity has become possible. As against this, after the domain of heredity had been allotted to the Ahrimanic beings as a result of the efforts of the primeval teachers, the Ahrimanic beings were obliged to renounce all interference with processes taking place in human evolution after death. Conversely, an agreement was also reached with the Luciferic beings, to the effect that they might exercise their influence on human beings only when they have passed through the gate of death and not before they descend into earthly existence. Thus the great primeval teachers were able to regulate the extra-earthly influences of Ahriman and Lucifer. But we have already heard, and a little reflection will at once make it obvious, that humanity is thereby brought into contact with nature. Because Ahrimanic beings can exert their influence on human beings before they descend to the earth, human beings are exposed to the operations of the forces of heredity. And because the Luciferic beings can work on them, human beings are exposed to factors in the physical environment, such as climate and the like, also to factors in the social and cultural environment, such as education, modes of behavior, and the like. Thus a relation is established between human beings and their natural environment, and the Ahrimanic and Luciferic beings can work into this environment. I now want to say something from a quite different aspect, about the existence these Ahrimanic and Luciferic beings lead, particularly in this natural environment. I have already referred to this subject when dealing with the theme of Michael, and I now want to go into it in more detail. Picture to yourselves the change that occurs in nature in the phenomenon of rising mist. We may perhaps be living in an atmosphere that is saturated with watery vapors rising up from the earth. Someone who has developed spiritual vision discovers that in this phenomenon of nature there is something that carries an earthly element upward in the centrifugal direction. It is not without reason that people who live in the misty areas become melancholic, for there is something about the experiencing of mists that weighs down the will. Now there are exercises whereby a person can manipulate his imagination so that he can himself weigh down his will. These exercises consist in concentrating on certain bodily organs, especially the muscles, whereby a kind of inner sensing, inner awareness of the muscles, is produced. The tension arising through this concentration, while standing still, is different from becoming aware of the muscles while walking. If such exercises are practiced consistently, like others described in the book titled How to Know Higher Worlds, the will is weighed down through a person's own activity, and then he sees what it is in the rising mist that can make people morose and melancholy. He perceives with the eyes of the soul and spirit that certain Ahrimanic beings live in the rising mists. Spiritual knowledge makes it clear that in rising mist, Ahrimanic beings rise up from the earth into cosmic space, thus expanding their sphere of action in the earthly realm. It is quite different, and there are excellent opportunities for this here at the Gertianum. If you gaze at the sky in the evening or in the morning, and see the clouds flooded with sunshine from above, a few days ago in the late afternoon you could have seen a kind of red golden light becoming embodied in the clouds, and calling forth an infinite variety of wonderful formations. And that same evening the moon shone with special intensity. Elsewhere, too, of course, you can see the clouds illuminated from above in a brilliant play of colors. Such a spectacle can be seen anywhere. I am merely speaking of what can be seen especially well here in Dornach. Just as Ahrimanic beings live in the rising mists, Luciferic beings live in the light, that fills the atmosphere and floods down onto the clouds. If someone can look at this with conscious imagination and succeeds in getting his thinking to accompany the forms and colors of the changing clouds, so that instead of having sharp outlines, his thoughts go through a metamorphosis, expanding and contracting together with the forms and colors of the clouds, then he will genuinely begin to see this play of colors above the clouds, especially in the evening and morning sky, as a sea of colors in which luciferic forms are moving. And whereas a mood of melancholy is produced in human beings by rising mist, his thoughts and also his heart learn to breathe with almost superhuman freedom at the sight of this luciferic sea of flowing light. This is a special relationship a human being can establish with the surrounding world, for then he can really rise to the feeling that his thinking is like an inhalation of the light. He feels his thinking to be a breathing, and what he is breathing is light. If this is actually experienced, the passage in the mystery plays about beings who breathe light will be better understood. Through this experience, a person can have a premonition of the nature of the sort of beings who breathe light. So we find that Ahrimanic and luciferic beings are also part and parcel of the phenomena of external nature. In the realm of heredity and adaptation to his environment, the human soul and spirit makes contact with nature. When we contemplate the rising mists and the clouds bathed in flowing light, we see how Ahrimanic and luciferic beings unite with the phenomena of nature. But when the human soul and spirit approach the facts of heredity and adaptation, this, as I have shown you today, is also simply approaching the forces of Lucifer and Ahriman. Thus, in the part of the human being that belongs to nature, we shall find Lucifer and Ahriman, and we find Lucifer and Ahriman again in certain natural phenomena, containing something that need not concern the physicist. And this is the very point from which we have the chance of perceiving nature influencing human beings in a way that transcends the phenomena of earthly existence. To begin with, let us hold firmly in our minds that Ahriman and Lucifer are present in the sphere of human heredity and adaptation. We find them in the rising mists and in the light that floods down onto the clouds where it is caught and held. And we find in human beings an urge to establish a balance, a rhythm between heredity and adaptation. We also find in external nature the urge to create rhythm between the two powers working in nature, the Ahrimanic and the Luciferic powers. If you follow the whole course of events in the world of nature, you have a wonderful drama. Follow the rising mist, and observe how Ahrimanic beings are striving outward into cosmic expanses. The moment the rising mists form themselves into a cloud, they have to give up their efforts and return again to earth. The clouds are where Ahriman's arrogant striving finds its limits. Clouds do not have the quality of mist in which Ahriman feels at home, but the clouds enable the light to spread out over them. Lucifer is there, above the clouds. Try to grasp this in its full significance. Picture the rising mists with the grayish, yellow, Ahrimanic forms concentrated in cloud masses, and in the light above the clouds, the luciferic forms striving downward. Then you have a picture of the Ahrimanic and the luciferic elements in nature. And then you will also realize that in times when people still had a feeling for what lies beyond the threshold, for what lives and weaves in the luminous clouds and in the rolling mist, the position of painters, for example, was quite different from later on. The spiritual powers they recognized carried the colors to the right place on the canvas. Poets, conscious that divinity, that spirituality was speaking in them, could say, "Sing, O Muse, of the wrath of Peleus' son Achilles," or "Sing to me, O Muse, of the man, the much-traveled one." These are the opening lines of Homer's epics. Klopstock, who lived in times when a feeling for the divine spiritual was no longer present, substituted, "Sing, immortal soul, of the redemption of sinful man." I have often spoken of this. Just as the poets of old would have said, could put it into words and begin their poems with it, The painters of old, too, even those living in the epoch of Leonardo and Raphael, would still have been able to say, and would have felt it in their own way, "Paint for me, O Muse, paint for me, O divine power. Direct my hands, bring my soul into my hands, so that the brush in my hands is guided by you." It is very important to understand this close union of human beings with the spirit in all situations of life, especially in the most significant ones. So we have arrived at the fact that on the one hand, in heredity and adaptation, we bring the human element itself into relationship with Ahriman and Lucifer, and on the other hand, through an intuitive observation of nature, Lucifer and Ahriman can be brought into relationship with nature in its external manifestations. We shall continue these studies in the lecture tomorrow, the end of lecture 2.